Hello, it's good to talk to you. We are entering the compressed end of semester period this term, in which weeks disappear and courses modify themselves, or else they don't, to take advantage of less time in which to be together. I want to respond to that requirement by compressing our forms of argument and mediated conversation as little as possible. The best way to do that is to treat everything from the final chords of the comedy of the First Amendment through the issues of trial rights as an example, not only required of us by the concern of the Bill of Rights with criminal trial, but as a general example of the difficulty shaping itself in the age of networked society, in what has come in the early months of the Biden administration to seem like a durable characteristic of American constitutional self-understanding for the next undetermined period of years, namely as a proof of the concept of democracy's value in networked society, plus enough running code to stave off the empowered autocracy, the perfected despotism, as I would prefer to call it, of the networked society operated on the model of the Chinese Communist Party's approach to ruling China. The form in which we consider that, which is the scope of the Sixth Amendment's particular interests in the criminal trial, needs to be somewhat expanded, but as we shall see, that's precisely where the middle line of the Sixth Amendment falls between tragedy of the fourth and comedy of the first. And all of that we need to do with an eye towards the fundamental structural question posed in what would be parts 9 and 14, but now can only be regarded as the early part of the course's conclusion, which is an effort to understand what we do with both the power of incorporation, that is the 14th Amendment's early model of the dissolving of borders in constitutional thought, a process which, drawn together by the railroad of the 19th century, is now far more advanced as borders disappear in all sorts of additional senses beyond those suggested by Sections 1 and 5 of the 14th Amendment, and also how the process of understanding reservation of rights to people, which is the great subject of the great and largely undisturbed Ninth Amendment, how those two structural ideas, the dissolution of borders and the reservation of rights, become, as it turns out, critical portions of the response of democratic societies in the net to perfected despotism in the net, all of which is, as I suppose I would like to think of it, the second semester conclusion part of the coming to the end of the year feeling, which the vernal equinox and the transition to daylight savings time jointly usher in. A time in which what I want to do is to sum up not only where we have just now been, but where I and those who have traveled the long distance in September have come to as we contemplate a world in which everything has changed, not the singularity when artificial intelligence becomes smarter than human beings and takes over, and extraordinary nightmare from which we do not have to awake because it hasn't happened and is, for present purposes, not possible to happen, but where we do, in fact, confront fundamental changes in the nature of what it is to be human, based upon the pervasive collection of human behavior and the not at all general, not really intelligent, quite artificial way in which that can be simply constructed into bonds that will hold us far too tight and do to our minds what it is, well, antithetical to the nature of humanity to do. Not a simple conclusion, and certainly not one that you can whistle on your way out of the theater, but the one for which we have been laboring together for either almost 24 or almost 12 weeks, weird as those distances may be, in the world of the epidemic, and plenty to have done, no matter how it is that we were called upon to do it. So over the next weeks, I feel that we are in different stages of returning to all the themes. A little new material is necessary to keep the fire burning, but as I look out from my isolation booth over Harlem and the East River and the Sound and, well, an airport hardly humming even now, I recognize that we may be able to see the end from here. I want to return to the question of the development of the First Amendment in the 21st century for a moment in order to consider in this particular context the general question of the pace and nature of constitutional change. What we have arrived at so far in our understanding of the First Amendment's immediate formative past and uncertain immediate future, is that the role of that sentence in the positive structuring of media in the 21st century comes to mean in the 21st government responsibility for the fundamentals of the technological design that are 21st century means of communication. If we're going to have centralized social networking of the presently existing kind, funded by the monetization of collected human behavior and routed through the parasite with a mind of God, then government in the end must be responsible for justifying the constitutional interventions that make it so. Which is hard for a government to do which doesn't necessarily believe anymore in the social and political route that is charted by such presently existing parasite with the mind of God operated, monetizing, behavioral collection funded structure of public information distribution. As government either tries to regulate that system or to move away from it, it should be compelled to justify under the First Amendment its efforts so to do, and that justification will indeed be required because across all of the polarized divisions in contemporary politics, one common ground, among the important common ground that we will articulate over the next 10 years, or we shall die trying, among the pieces of common ground is distrust of that system, which will never again be able to compel the, oh, gee whiz, the internet, how wonderful kind of monoclonal structure for the the growth of everybody's public policy attitudes. Let's just not crush this wonderful infant industry that, I mean, nobody believes that anymore. And let's just make the world open and more connected. Nobody believes that anymore. And don't be evil. Good luck to you if you're going to try and do it that way. Everybody gets it. Being the privacy invasion subcontractors to all of the other businesses in society and bilaterally monopolizing the process of, quote, advertising, close quote, which is the auction-based opportunities to monetize what we know about you, along with a general technological and architectural tilt in the direction of systems based on monetizing what we know about you, is simply not going to be the flavor of the month in the leading edge of global democracy. However much it may turn out to have been a favorable architecture for perfected despotism in managed economy capitalist under autocracy states. So we should expect that the leading phenomena in the adjustment of the First Amendment for the 21st century will be situations in which the regulation of presently existing social media, which is now on the charts for political reasons, will produce constitutional questions raised on all sides about how freedom of speech rules coexist with regulations of the bad architecture we now have, while the state and its adversaries rush to control the private entities whose misbehavior or potential for misbehavior they are also attempting to regulate. As Charles Black so beautifully proved in The People of the, and the Court so long ago, that is more than half a century ago, the people have forgotten that he proved it. The most important purpose of federal judicial review of at least federal legislation is to uphold it. That is to set the boundaries of constitutionality by finding legislation constitutional. And thus, we should expect that the articulation of new First Amendment principles will not necessarily occur in what are seen as landmark cases refusing government the opportunity to structure information media in the new world, but just as often in cases in which such government power is upheld, but the principles that on which it is upheld, that is to say, the reasons why its regulatory interventions are constitutional or why the legislation establishing regulatory structures and standards of regulation, what we may think of as new privacy law, will be constitutional, the principles will have been established that there is broad federal responsibility, and that responsibility, however discharged, when it preempts state responsibility, must meet constitutional standards, and therefore there are affirmative duties connected both at the federal and the state levels with the way in which we structure the inherently closer to the citizen modes of communication now available in the 21st century than the supposedly technologically necessary, highly centralized uses of electromagnetic spectrum and highly capitalized uses of the press in the 20th century. The post-industrial model of information distribution will require regulation of various environmental privacy-related kinds, and often that legislation will be upheld, and sometimes it will be required because the general understanding of the positive responsibility of government, state, and federal under the First Amendment will necessarily result, whether the initial steps in the government of the information society are upheld or are invalidated. In roughly the same time scale, which we can think of as 10 to 15 years from now, It will also have become apparent that closer to citizen media, in which the mediation has less to do with the centralized power of a few publishers to decide what will be discussed, and more to do with the possibility of large-scale determination of what will be discussed by the people discussing it, also comes to emphasize the equality principle in the non-abridgment of freedom of speech that is in the First Amendment, which was less visible under 20th century conditions because technology was more centralizing and the result was more privilege of communication due to wealth. As we cope with what is already in existence on a constitutional basis, which we do as government increases its inclination to try to achieve what the legislature and the agencies think of as the public welfare by controlling private power in public interest, as those activities occur, it becomes more clear that the principle of non-abridgment implies a principle of equalization, which will be sought avidly by those who wish to constrain private power more aggressively than the other parts or elements of government with which, in the ordinary business of policy making and policy enforcement, they contend. The litigation and the campaigning that can be done by that part of society which actively wishes to expand government's responsibility to equalize communications power in society and to empower people both to make expressive use of what they know and to make private use of their opportunities to read and learn and to discuss before they begin or while they act also as teachers in the public sphere. The process by which we are drawn into a larger number of such conversations is in fact the change in climate of opinion. Like the adjustment to mass media in the first two decades of the 20th century, or three, let us say, that give rise to the flowering of the First Amendment from 1940 through, well, one hopes, the present day. In other words, we are entering a period in which the adjustments in the understanding of the First Amendment are likelier to occur through the process of acquaintance with new conditions, however those new conditions may be reflected in the facts before the court. And we should expect that by the early 2030s, we are beginning to experience interactions between new legislation and new forms of constitutional interpretation, which will then drive for another decade or two the development of the First Amendment under 21st century conditions. This is your working lifetime's growing moments that we are talking about. The time from the end of your legal education to the fulfillment of the first half of the intentions of your practice. That will be the period in which this growth of the 21st century First Amendment will occur, roughly paralleling, slightly faster and offset in time from the last century's timeline. A similar process of the underlying adjustment of agile constitutional material to transformed technical and social conditions of communication. Involvement in the judicial understanding of whatever it is that will be before the courts will be the process by which that adaptation happens. It will be then possible to begin to think about systematically employing new judicial thinking in the tailoring of progressive legislation and irritating litigation in the period in which you will be, well, highly experienced and capable lawyers in various parts of the world. This, I mean to suggest, is your appointment with the 21st century First Amendment, which is roughly on your schedule. We can see the end from here of the period in which conceptual adjustment has occurred in the cases and can be used as the pole propelling legislation through the water. As we can imagine, legislation in a deep First Amendment New Deal escaping from legislatures determined themselves to expand the boundary by imaginative design. I say that we can imagine that, but at least with respect to the Federal Congress, we would have to imagine also an entirely new set of political conditions. And with respect to the states, we would have to expect the last 100 years of public utilities regulation development to escape the forms of capture and patronization which have grown up everywhere between the utilities and their regulators, and therefore to imagine a kind of changed relationship of politics to infrastructure, which even $3 trillion of federal spending would not change, and which we must understand to be now a new structural limitation, like the narrow ownership of mass press, newspaper press, in the 20th century was to the development of new politics. But grow we will. The First Amendment's elements require its growth in the same way that the Fourth Amendment elements require its limitation in the world of the new technology of the 21st century, and thus, not only here but elsewhere in the world, not because the First Amendment is the law of anywhere else, it most definitely isn't. Not because everybody else is going to toss all their forms of reasonable restrictions and other public welfare exceptions to the general strength of libertarian absoluteness of the freedom of speech in the United States, but rather because informational democracy is the only form of democracy that the 21st century can employ, an informational society where information is power. If there is to be democracy, the people have to have power over information. And because that is indeed the other side of the conflict now increasingly seen, not just by us techno guys, but by, well, the Joe Bidens of the world, in which informational democracy is really the only alternative to perfected despotism. And we find ourselves actively engineering to save freedom, a thing which those people in my movement have been doing since late in the 20th century, but which will soon have caught on at a level that we could never have dreamed of, as society actually recognizes that it must confront the choice between technologically assisted freedom designed as technology for freedom and the only other thing that can happen, which is very dark indeed. I point this in order to explain that the comedy of the First Amendment doesn't end with a wedding happening now, in the period after COVID when people can gather again and take off their masks, but that it is the possibility of your lifetime, the likelihood, I hope, in important senses, of your lifetime, that it has a comic quality because it isn't tragic, and because, as Hugo Weaving said once upon a time, what's a revolution without dancing? But we will know when we know what you've done. Because the lawyers who are going to do it, they are you. On that basis, and under the understanding that we may not yet be done discussing these points lest until you have finished on the pad discussing them and writing about them and producing what is whatever might be personally your jumping off point among the essays for the understanding that this will happen in the great period of your growth as lawyers and that it might be even what you do. Let us take a different part of what you might do, what others around us in this class might do. The Constitution of the United States is not 1787's response to the conditions of 1774, 5, or 6, as has been understood in different contexts throughout the subsequent historiography of the United States, and particularly since the publication of Charles Beard's Economic Interpretation of the United States Constitution in 1912, it has been well understood that the Federal Constitution of 1787 is better seen as an anti-revolutionary document than as a revolutionary one, as a thermidor, as it's so often described. But once again, to think of the Constitution primarily as intended to put a stop to the revolutionary activities in British, post-British North America, and to build an imperial federal government capable of wielding a sufficient army to possess the continent and to produce not only the long-term independence of the United States, but their cohesion through the occupation of the great land of North America, that document is unquestionably also, once the Bill of Rights has been fitted on it by the First Congress, a full education in the fears of the generation that made the Revolution and that in slightly later life conjoined with George Washington as the only man whom they would trust to wield executive power over that empire and its army, the fears that had led them over the course of the period from 1761 to 1781 to live in terror of the unchained empire's power over them. Benjamin Franklin wasn't jesting when he said to the Continental Congress that if they didn't hang together, they would all hang separately. And the experience of the fear of the imperial boot on their necks produced a good deal of the law with which they were going to saddle the Federal Imperial Republic lest it bite them. Hence it is the case that both in Article 3 of the original document and in the Sixth Amendment authored by the First Congress, the problem of criminal venue is seen as an absolutely crucial one. Fear of being taken to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and tried there without a jury on charges of conducting the kind of smuggling that every reputable merchant in Boston, Newport, New York, and Philadelphia and Charleston was engaged in during the 1750s and 60s, that fear runs deep and is also part of the fear of political dissidents who also believe that they can be taken back to England and charged with treason there. The place of the criminal trial, which is also the importance of the jury of the vicinage as the ultimate check on the despotism of centralized royal or imperial or presidential power is a lesson so deeply drummed in that they repeat themselves to indicate the crucial point of the physical place of trial and its relation to the jury. What the First Congress says, you won't be surprised to hear me begin by pointing out, is a sentence containing a list divided by semicolons, which are not clauses, but items. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. In other words, after all, the power of the state to bring to criminal trial shall be permanently limited, first with respect to the imperial federal government by the 18th century authors, and later, thanks to the incorporation of these provisions in the Due Process Clause of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, to every state government and its subdivisions conducting criminal prosecutions. We can give a historical account, as I have done in other contexts, to the particulars of this list. And in particular, to give to the legislative discussion over criminal defendants' rights in political cases at the end of the 17th century, when the question of the access of the defendant to the specifics of the charges, to a bill of particulars before trial, and the assistance of counsel were seen as highly important political privileges in political cases, and the uncharted, largely legislatively unmarked development of the general right to assistance of counsel in felony, which at the opening of the 18th century was specifically denied. Those charged with felony were not entitled to assistance of counsel. To the process through the 18th century in which both the Americans first and the English second came increasingly to accept that those charged with serious crimes might hire lawyers. We are, of course, long before the discovery in America in the second half of the 20th century that if they can't afford lawyers, they should have lawyers anyway, appointed for them, funded by the people. Merely that counsel is allowed, which is, as my colleague in the legal history of constitutional and criminal law, John Blankbein, once said, not, I mean, as a remark off the cuff, but as the premise of an entire area of legal historical inquiry. John has always been a man who did well in the formulation of large questions. John Langbein's fundamental question, what did the introduction of defense counsel do to the history of criminal procedure, for which he made large claims it created the law of evidence that were a little larger than the situation of the facts on the ground over hundreds of years would allow for, but which nonetheless remains the profoundest of questions in the history of criminal procedure. What does the introduction of defense counsel do? The Sixth Amendment stands for the political reasons, the deep, bitter lessons of the Revolutionary period as they inscribed themselves in the minds of lawyers and political thinkers who had been for independence or against the crown in the United States in the period after 1761. And who felt definitely that they were not going to be forced, if they could avoid it, to pay for their dissidence in the coin demanded by despotism. We are not done, of course, in our world, with trying to understand the ways in which state power may use criminal process to undermine freedom fundamentally. And our unsuccess in adapting the Fourth Amendment's particular concerns, the ones equally important to and equally practical in their implications for the First Congress, leave us now with a slightly different kind of question when we come to the trial rights that the First Congress and the generation of British North Americans it represented felt themselves concerned about. The problem of long holding without charges is not a problem that is without parallel in the 21st century, but it has been assumed in the period of the last 100 years or so that speedy trial is really the prosecution's right, that highly efficient and well-funded processes of police investigation and large professionalized prosecutorial services, those do good jobs at collecting evidence and preparing cases for trial in a speedy fashion. And defendants are those only who can profit from the deterioration of witness memories, the rusting of files, the loss to entropy of the knowledge and energy that the system possessed on the morning of arrest. It is therefore assumed in the federal courts, for example, by statute, the Speedy Trial Act, that it is reasonable to demand of the state that it be ready for trial in all cases within 70 days of the first appearance of the defendant before a magistrate, presumably shortly after arrest. The likelihood of violation of the Speedy Trial Act by a federal prosecutorial service is very slight. The penalty for failing to bring a case speedy to trial, it has been repeatedly held in the federal courts, is dismissal of the charging document, indictment, or information with prejudice. As big a penalty as the prosecution can pay. But we recognize that the very point is that, in general, speedy trial is the prosecution's right, and the government will only delay trial by motion or otherwise in cases in which it has a particularly strong interest, and which, even allowing for the politics of making sure that you get the guy, are much more likely to be in cases involving political motives for prosecution than those in which government merely wishes to show that it doesn't let the grass grow under its feet where citizens' safety is concerned. And what it means to hold a public trial in a world in which, as we are well aware, not only in the United States, but in England and elsewhere, the course of ordinary criminal justice has been vastly interrupted, delayed, and in some cases more or less shut down altogether by the epidemic, shows us how difficult the guarantee of speedy and public trial is in mass society. But fully in the recognition that where we are willing to compromise either with respect to quality in order to attain speed or network accessibility in order to guarantee the access of the public, we are risking the form of accountability to the citizenry directly that the principle of speedy and public trial sets forth in the Sixth Amendment. For, of course, the Sixth Amendment's basic principle is to align the interests of the community as a whole with the interests of each criminal defendant as an individual with respect to the power of the state to use processes of trial as a place for the gaining of political advantage over democracy. The power of the state to use systems of punishment for that purpose lies within the domain of constraint established by the Eighth Amendment. And there are particular issues which we won't be talking about in this course, but which I've spent some portion of my professional time as a legal historian thinking about, that are centered in the prohibition of self-incrimination in the Fifth. But the sense of the Sixth Amendment is neither about punishment nor is it about either how prosecutions are initiated or whether the accused can be forced to testify against herself. But rather with the rights of the defendant upon trial and the community's role in holding accountable the force of the state to secure those rights. A speedy and a public trial in which the accused may have process for obtaining witnesses and assistance of counsel is a process in which the accused may ask both the observing community and the specific community of the impartial jury to exercise control over the power to try, to accuse, and to punish. And the sentence, which is the Sixth Amendment, balances those elements in which the community of observers, the impartial locals chosen from the proper place, and the processes of examination of witnesses at trial with assistance of counsel all coincide. Counsel inevitably plays the role that we expect in the construction of the presentation of the narrative with which the accused meets the state. The requirement of compulsory process and the assistance of counsel are inherently those matters which the 18th century slowly and almost imperceptibly in both the colonies and at home granted to felony defendants. The specification of charges is primarily the outcome of a seesaw of legislative effort and breakdown between the House of Lords and Commons and the disagreement of the King occurring in England between the Revolution of 1688 and the eventual enactment of the Treason Act's provisions in 1697. But the specific elements of legal development that led to the pieces inside the semicolons of the Sixth Amendment are in that sense less important than the political and legal controversies in British North America between 1761 and the end of the Revolution, which produced the fear of particular government corruption of the trial process by manipulation of venue, by denial of the opportunity to call one's own evidence effectively if transported long distance away from the place where the witnesses who would exonerate you are, And from the jury, which, whatever the nature of its local prejudices might be, serves finally on the check of government power. Now, we are no longer in the late 18th century, and in our world, both the world of the epidemic, in which the pressure for remote activity in government and education and business and society has been so great, and where the technology for remoting everything has been available on whatever it may have been its questionable terms, this issue, how might government control the rights of the community and its individual citizens through corruption of trial process using the net, is real. The Chinese Communist Party's use of politically influenced courts, which decide cases in secret after lengthy periods of investigation and no particular notice to the community of trial, using decision makers who are politically influenced and denying to the lawyers who might be the defendant's assistants their opportunity to practice, whether simply by the assignment of compliant persons or by the direct assault of the state machinery upon defense counsel, all demonstrate how perfected despotism will work. The question isn't then, in our minds so much, will the United States government use Zoom to create a system in which no witnesses are ever live confronted by defense counsel again and charges are only available on Snapchat disappearing messages or some such thing? But rather how informational democracy chooses to implement 18th century conceptions about trial rights so as to achieve the maximum of accountability to the jury and the community in the real world of the 21st century. And here, of course, there are a variety of problems which are not problems only for the defendant to consider, but in which the community has in every sense its own stake in the question of accountability. Televised trials, as the Supreme Court said in the case of Billy Saul Estes all the way back in the mid-1960s, televised trials risk the production of circus to the disadvantage of both the defendant's rights and the impartial conduct of justice. What was said about televisions in the courtroom in the era of network news is not less true of the possibility of circus making in the world of 21st century social media. On the contrary, it is now easier to understand the modes of engineering by which individual or group actors in the world of social media can cause a criminal trial to become a circus for a range of purposes that don't serve either the interests of the community or of the defendants. And we are in no way unaware of the forms in which, for a variety of reasons, whether they have to do with preventing the harm done to certain kinds of victims of crime, children subjected to sexual abuse, for example, it is desirable to use methods of communication for the taking of testimony and the conduct of cross-examination which do not involve the face-to-face in the courtroom confrontations upon which Anglo-American criminal justice typically runs and which the Sixth Amendment appears always to guarantee. So we are asking questions like, if the guarantee of an impartial jury required in the 20th century, the trial judges give admonitions to jury members against reading the newspapers or watching the news. Can restrictions on the use of the net by jurors during the period of trial, conducted by technological surveillance of those jurors, be upheld? Is it within the rights of the defense to require jury impartiality to be protected by restrictions on the network use of jurors? If it was constitutional to sequester jurors, and if sequestration was only used in cases in which the government felt that it could justify the expense, not in cases in which the government felt it could justify the restraint on juror liberties, then why shouldn't it be possible to restrain jurors from communicating through the net with facts or evidence or statements or lies generated outside the courtroom if that can be cheaply done? Must we in the end come to understand more deeply what the Sixth Amendment guarantees by way of impartiality and limit that by the recognition that jurors have come to have rights since the year 1660 or so, and that merely imprisoning them without fire or light until they return a verdict overnight is not a sufficient basis upon which to conduct ourselves with respect to the ultimate judges of the legitimacy of government behavior. Instead, then, we are required to understand in 21st century terms, in the context of the network as a whole, the series of measures for the accountability of criminal justice process to the community and to the defendant. And we need to understand where, in the course of 20th century technological development, we concluded things about the role of the information media of distribution in relation to the criminal justice process that may not be fully sufficient in conditions of informational democracy. What in the world of the net does a public trial mean with respect to the public's ability to see the trial? And what does it mean with respect to the defendant's right to have the community's view of the trial as part of what holds the government responsible, accountable, for the inevitable risks to freedom that are involved in prosecution, trial, and punishment of crime? We will not reach definite conclusions. We have yet to frame all the cases, or even some of the most important ones, as I've just suggested with respect to control of impartiality. We built up in the world of the death penalty some ideas about the nature of effective assistance of counsel, largely through the effort to use habeas corpus proceedings to review the adequacy of counsel's assistance in the trial court and on direct appeal, only to have the Supreme Court impose a deep form of constitutional error doctrine upon all of that effort in Strickland against Wainwright, by requiring the demonstration that whatever the errors of assistance of counsel were, they would have been dispositive. No rational jury would have convicted had the errors of the assistance of in the assistance of counsel that are under review not been made. It's important then, with respect to the conduct of criminal defense in the 21st century, given the powers of investigation now available and the enormous inequalities in access to information in society to begin requiring both some constitutional standards for how criminal defense is conducted and some constitutional standards for how the community pays for the cost of adequate criminal defense, which we have from Gideon against Wainwright to Argy Singer against Hamlin, required that the state provide to parties charged first with felonies and then with misdemeanors that could result in significant jail time. And this, again, has to do with the role that large-scale access to data analysis plays, both in the way prosecutions are conducted and in the way that defenses must be carried on. We had begun by the end of the 20th century, through the efforts of the Barry Scheck and the Innocence Project, to consider the adaptations necessary to criminal justice process once both forms of forensic science and the forms of genetic analysis have become more crucial to the conduct of prosecution. Soon, processes of data analytics and data science will be essential in the conduct of criminal prosecution and difficult for the assistance of counsel to meet effectively without a variety of rules concerning how computer programs must be run and what must be visible about them and how their results must be subjected to alternate forms of statistical or data science analysis, etc., etc. All of which do relate directly to the trial rights expressed in the Sixth Amendment, but which require the elements in the adjectives, the effective assistance of counsel and the informed of the nature of the accusation and confronted with witnesses, all of which require us to inspect the underlying technological infrastructure by which information comes to court. But let's pause for your element of the conversation. Let us think it through. Let us bring to bear the various examples you would offer. And at the beginning of next week's class, as we attempt to begin the processes of summing up in the long view, I'll come back to offering some specific interpretive guidance, as I think it can be laid out now, of what the 21st century Sixth Amendment will have to be about. Talk to you soon.